I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. You may have missed President Obama's announcement in late July about a plan to increase fuel economy standards. Most of the news from Washington was about the fight over the debt ceiling. Flanked by union leaders and automakers, Mr. Obama said that by 2025, cars will get 54.5 miles per gallon. For light trucks, the increase will be more modest, but will be an improvement over today's standards. Then a week later, the president announced new fuel economy standards for medium and heavy-duty trucks. The administration vowed that this will save money at the pump, will reduce pollution, and cut the country's dependence on foreign oil. Well, today on Radio Times, how realistic are these new fuel economy standards? What's the technology that will enable automakers to build these vehicles? And will there be a market for them? And we have two guests who have joined us by telephone. Michelle Krebs is the editor-in-chief of Auto Observer and analyst at Edmunds.com. She's been covering the automotive industry for 30 years. Michelle Krebs, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is David Friedman. He's an engineer and deputy director of the Clean Vehicles Program, and that's at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And David Friedman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much.
Michelle, let me begin with you. Is this a realistic goal?
Well, apparently the automakers think so, because President Obama was surrounded by many of them at the signing of this. So haggling was done behind the scenes in terms of talking to the automakers about what they could achieve. So apparently.
Well, and I wonder whether part of those negotiations were the fact that the U.S. Bailed out the auto industry, and the auto industry, in a sense, owed the country something, Michelle?
Well, it was more than that. I mean, it was more than a dozen automakers that were involved, and Chrysler and GM are the ones that got the bailouts. I think, you know, they know the direction is clear, that we have to increase fuel economy and we have to lower emissions. So I think part of it is that the automakers have always balked at anything the government wanted to require, and so they're trying to change that image a bit. The other thing that we don't know, the big caveat in this, we don't know all the loopholes in this. All that is going to be worked out as we go forward.
And we'll pick up on that. David, let me get you to weigh in on this as well. Are you heartened by this agreement?
Well, overall, I think that this is an incredibly important step. Boosting fuel economy standards and cutting global warming pollution through these regulations will save about 1.5 million barrels of oil per day by 2030. That's about what we currently import from Saudi Arabia and Iraq combined. So this is clearly a big step. And obviously the automakers are on board. They know they've got the technology. They've got incredibly talented engineers and auto workers who can put these cars together and actually create more jobs in the auto industry and throughout the economy by saving people money at the pump. So they make a lot of sense. I think Michelle makes a really good point that the devil's always in the details of things like this, and we know that some of the automakers, part of the reason why they signed on board is they did negotiate in some loopholes, and we've got to keep an eye on those to make sure that consumers actually get the benefits they've been promised.
Now, we're talking about 50, this is for cars, 54.5 miles per gallon in 15 years by the year 2025. David, what's the typical gas mileage for a car today?
Well, here's where I hate to say, but it gets really complicated.
Okay.
Because
yes,
the government
does
keeps two sets of books. One set of books is the fuel economy levels that automakers certify to comply with the law. The other set of books is what the rest of us see, which is what's on your window sticker. So given that, this 54-mile-per-gallon standard actually will turn into window stickers somewhere on the order of 36 to 38 miles per gallon. That's up from about 21 miles per gallon for the average window sticker today. So still an impressive improvement, but maybe not quite as big as it sounds. Incredibly important. But because the government keeps two books, it can get pretty confusing for consumers.
Well,
and that's a great point.
And I am confused. No, go ahead, Michelle.
Well, it's a great point, because I think that people read those headlines and they said, wow, I am going to get 54.5 miles per gallon on my car. That's not at all the case, because they calculate the mileage for CAFE one way, and they calculate for the stickers that go on the cars in a different way. Mm. And throw in electric cars, and you've really got it complicated. So, you know, the average consumer is not going to get 54 miles a gallon.
Well,
that's what I think we need to make clear to consumers.
No, and I appreciate both of you making that point, because, to be honest with you, I thought we were going to be talking about 54.5 miles per gallon. I was very excited about
that.
No,
well,
that's
think about
okay.
It this way.
Go ahead.
the way these cars are tested, they basically put them on a treadmill and they run them over a standard cycle. So picture yourself just jogging lightly on a treadmill and how much water you need to keep pace, how much food you need to fuel you to walk, say, 1 mile on a treadmill. But now picture what you're actually going to do in daily life is jog that mile. It's going to take more energy. It's going to be harder. That's the problem here. These cars, when they're driven out on the road, they're jogging or even running around the streets, while the tests are more like walking on a treadmill.
And just picking up on that, Michelle, then the window sticker is the kind of mileage in real life.
Yes.
Or close to that.
We are hearing a lot of complaints that people are not achieving that either. If you think about all the different circumstances, I mean, the treadmill analogy is a great one. Mm-hmm. When you go outside, it's a different temperature. It's, you're going uphill, you're going downhill. So the circumstances are always different.
Well, and then not to put a total cloud over our conversation here, but going back to you, David, then, and going back to this agreement between the Obama administration and the auto industry, this is still, though, a sign of progress.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, the oil savings numbers I just quoted you of about 1.5 million barrels per day, that's based on real-world performance, not based on what they get on these tests. It's, again, based on that real-world performance, consumers during just the first 5 years of ownership of these vehicles will be saving about $5,000 at the pump. Uh-huh. That's at a gas price of $3.60 a gallon. So 5 years worth of savings is about $5,000, and that's for an upfront cost of around $2,000 to $3,000 for the technology. So during the first 5 years of ownership, when most people have a loan on their car, they're going to be saving money. The investment in fuel economy is going to pay off in, say, 2 to 3 years compared to where we are today. That's a pretty good deal, and that's at that 36-mile-per-gallon window sticker value.
So, Michelle, looking forward then, and we're talking about hybrid technology, battery technology, that's what's going to increase these fuel standards?
Well, I think the very first thing we're already seeing right now is your typical gasoline engine is being improved tremendously. We've got 40-mile-per-gallon gasoline engine cars out there. Cars will probably be smaller because it takes less fuel to move a smaller car. And yes, we'll see more hybrids. We'll see more different kinds of hybrids. We'll see like mild versions. GM is doing something called the E-Assist, which is not quite a full hybrid, but it does improve fuel economy a bit. We'll see full electric cars like the Nissan Leaf. We're going to see a whole menu of options.
And from your perspective, David, what's the outer limit for a gas engine?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, you could definitely take the gasoline engine and combine it with other improvements, with stronger materials, better transmission, better tires, improved aerodynamics. And studies from groups like the Massachusetts Institute of Technology or the University of California have pointed to those technologies alone being able to boost fuel economy to 40 to 50 miles per gallon comfortably. You add hybrids on top of that, and you can be talking 60 to 70 miles per gallon. So by 2025, we estimate that to meet these standards, maybe about half to 60% of the fleet will still be running around on gasoline or diesel engines, just much more efficient cars, and then another 40% of the fleet, roughly, will be hybrids like the Toyota Prius or the Ford Fusion Hybrid. You actually won't need any electric cars, no battery vehicles, no plug-in hybrids to meet these standards, though there are incentives in the program to try to encourage automakers to make them. But you won't even need any to actually comply with these standards.
Michelle, anything you want to add to that?
No, I mean, the other point I was going to raise, I think we'll see new materials, too. David was mentioning a lot of the different ways we can get there. We'll see more lightweight materials. There's a lot of emphasis on that. I mean, to get better fuel economy in Europe, why? Vehicles are smaller. So that will be a big part of the equation.
David.
And I think really important point about that. I think, Michelle, I totally agree that we're going to see vehicles that are lighter. But we're going to get there not by making cars smaller, but by using high-strength steel and aluminum alloys, magnesium, materials like that that can keep the same size as we have today in terms of the cars, but cut out weight. And why is that? Well, this is another one of those potentially complicated stories, but I'll try not to go too far there. The new standards are scaled to the size of the vehicle. So the bigger the vehicle, the weaker the standard. So the automakers actually have no incentive to make vehicles smaller. They have an incentive to make them lighter, using materials that will keep the vehicle just as safe or safer than they are today, but the standards actually encourage them to get a little bit bigger. So I think what we're most likely to see are cars and trucks that are the same sizes as they are today, with the same utility they deliver today. They'll be a little bit lighter, they'll be a lot more efficient, and when gas prices spike to $4 and $5 a gallon, people will actually be able to afford to drive them.
Well, Michelle, let me go back to you, and this, of course, raises the question about the role of the consumer, the role of consumer demand for either smaller cars or more efficient cars, and I'm assuming gas prices drive a lot of consumer demand.
Absolutely, and here is the issue. We see distinctly that when gasoline prices go up, and $3.50 used to be the threshold, maybe it's closer to $4 now, consumers go to more fuel-efficient vehicles. In this stretch, we've seen them go to a lot of the very small cars. There might be an economic factor in there, too, because those tend to cost less, too. But the last 3 months, for instance, when gasoline prices have dipped down, we've seen a decline in hybrid sales and that whole genre of not just exclusively gasoline engines. So that is going to be the challenge. And the other challenge will be, you know, these technologies come at a cost. And, you know, David makes a point that, you know, you get a payback, but if gasoline prices aren't... don't move up. I know this sounds horrible, but if they don't move up, then there's really not a lot of incentive for consumers to buy them.
Because it's going to, it sounds like you're both saying, and Michelle, we're about 45 seconds from our first break here, is that these cars being developed will probably cost more, but the savings come at the pump?
Well, you don't get something for nothing. You're going to be adding direct injection technology to the engines. You're going to be adding extra gears to the transmission. You've got to invest money in order to put that technology on board. The estimates from the government are that this will boost the price of a vehicle maybe $2,000 more than what we're expecting in 2016. But if you're a typical car buyer and you take out a 5-year loan, the day you drive off the lot, you're going to be saving more money on gasoline than you're going to be facing an increased loan payment. So there will be an increased upfront cost, but given the way most people finance their vehicles, you will actually be saving from day one.
Well, let's take a short break. And Michelle, if you want to add to that, we'll pick up on that point after this very short break. We're talking about the new fuel efficiency standards. They were announced in the last week or so. You may have missed it because there was so much news about the fight over the debt ceiling. David Friedman, an engineer, deputy director of the Clean Vehicle Program at the University of Concerned Scientists. Michelle Krebs, editor-in-chief of Auto Observer and an analyst at Edmunds.com. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art supports WHYY, presenting Rembrandt and the Face of Jesus, the first exhibition in Philadelphia ever to include the rare painting, prints, and portraits of Rembrandt, the great painter of the Dutch Golden Age. Rembrandt and the Face of Jesus reassembles a group of more than 50 intimate portraits of Christ that have not been seen together since they left the artist's home in Amsterdam more than 350 years ago, on view through October 30th only. More information at philamuseum.org.
At the heart of everything we do at WHYY is one thing, storytelling. We try to inform, engage, inspire, and connect through deep, colorful stories. And NewsWorks Tonight brings together the best reporting from our network of journalists in one smart, lively regional news magazine. Weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM, or listen online at WHYY.org and NewsWorks.org. There's also the podcast, and you can follow NewsWorks Tonight on Twitter and Facebook. And that's the story.
I'm Dave Holmes. Bob Mould has spent 30 years at the forefront of the American indie music scene with his bands Husker Du and Sugar and as a solo artist, and he's done it as something of an underground gay icon.
Gay punk rock, or gays in punk rock, it was sort of like gays in the military, really. You know, it was like the era of don't ask, don't tell. You know, it was sort of don't advertise, don't worry.
Bob Mould is my guest this week on The Sound of Young America from PRI.
tomorrow night at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Michelle Krebs and David Friedman about the new fuel efficiency standards that were just announced by the Obama administration, new standards for the automobile industry and for truck makers. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Michelle, going back to you and picking up on consumers and what they want and what perhaps the government may or may not be doing to increase consumer demand for some of these more efficient vehicles. Are there things like tax credits that are part of this deal?
Well, absolutely. And I wanted to go back to the payoff when you buy these more expensive, higher technology vehicles. That payoff depends entirely on what gas prices are at.
Right.
So while we may anticipate that gas prices are going up, you know, it may not be the case. And many people in Edmunds.com stand is that there really needs to be a gas tax to encourage, and that's, we will get a lot of calls on that.
Yes, we will.
I guarantee you, to put gasoline at a price that it actually does make it favorable to change consumer behavior in that regard.
And by that also sort of stop the fluctuation of a gas price or just keep it high?
Well, keep it high and just encourage consumer behavior, because consumers, when gas prices are high, change their behavior. When gas prices are low, they go back to what they've bought in the past.
So there's an extra factor in here in the economics on this. I mean, when you look at the way the market is supposed to work, one of the things consumers are supposed to have is choice. And part of the problem with the marketplace right now is there actually isn't enough choice. If I'm a parent of three kids who need to be in car seats, I need a minivan. And if the gas prices go up, I can't shift to a compact car to save fuel today. That won't work for me. I can't take my kids to school. I can't take my kids to daycare. So what these regulations will do is they will ensure that parent of three kids in the minivan can actually buy a minivan that gets significantly higher fuel economy. And that's missing from the market today. So, yes, when gas prices go up, what usually happens is people shift to smaller vehicles. But that's because they're being forced to sacrifice and buy vehicles that they may not exactly want, because that's the only way they can save money on gas. These regulations will give them a whole new way to save money on gas and to keep the vehicle that they want. So while I agree with Michelle that as gas prices go up and down, that will affect the market, it all depends on the choices consumers have. They don't have good choices today. These regulations will ensure that they do have those choices. And by the way, the payback calculations I did, they were at $3.60 a gallon. That's today's gas price. Hmm. That's a gas price in the middle of tough economic times around the world. Picture what's going to happen once the worldwide economy recovers and demand for oil goes up. Oil prices are going to go up. But even at today's $3.60 a gallon gas price, Michelle talked about it as a low gas price, you would see payback right away.
Michelle, let me ask you about medium and heavy-duty trucks. And again, this was another announcement. I think it did get buried by all the news coming out of Washington. But as I understand and as I read it, this is the Obama administration announcing new fuel economy standards for big trucks. Is this a first?
Well, and again, it was done in the same kind of way. The Obama administration got most of the organizations that represent truck makers and truck owners on board to accept these. And it is huge, because those are the vehicles on American roads that guzzle the most fuel. So that's significantly important. Now, there is a contingent that's opposing these, especially truckers who are small businesses and see that this will raise their cost of doing business. But it's significant.
Do you agree it's significant, David?
It's definitely significant. There have never been fuel economy or global warming pollution regulations for trucks. And by trucks here, we're talking about everything from the largest pickups to FedEx trucks, all the way up to cement mixers, buses, and big rigs. This is the first time we will ever have standards for these vehicles. And when you combine the savings from these standards with the savings from the light-duty vehicles, we'll be cutting oil dependence by more than we currently import from the entire Persian Gulf. So absolutely, this is an incredibly important step. On the heavy side, the standards are not as strong as they could be, without a doubt, but there's room for another round of standards. And you know, the interesting thing about the argument about small businesses is, again, this actually isn't going to increase their operating costs. It's going to lower their operating costs. It's going to allow small businesses to potentially hire more people, to drive more trucks, to deliver more goods at a better price, which will help rev up our economy. We recently did a study of these standards, and it indicated that you could generate about 80,000 new jobs by 2030 due to the investments in better technology and the money that people would save. If you're spending money on going out to dinner or buying a new present, instead of spending it on oil dependence, you're actually going to create jobs in America.
Well, Michelle, picking up on that, let me go back to you. And proponents, and this is in part the Obama administration, and it comes from other people and organizations as well, is that by increasing fuel efficiency, we reduce emissions, we create jobs, we drive innovation, we save money, we reduce our dependence on foreign oil. It sounds like a win-win-win from just about every perspective. Is this overselling this idea?
No, I think that it is a win-win-win. And you know what? America's not alone. And I think that's why we absolutely have to do this, and that's why I think you saw so many car companies on board. Europe's had a strong standards for a long time, especially on emissions. They've done a tremendous job with research of diesel technology because that's what they decided was going to be their answer at the time. We certainly will see China do a lot more. You know, the emissions, the air is around all of us. It isn't just in America. It's just a huge issue. I think it would be wonderful if we all got to a point that, you know, we could agree on global standards, but I'm not sure that will ever happen.
Well, and David, just again picking up on that, and will this affect things like public transportation? Because I know in many ways that's the biggest saver of all, if you can get people out of their cars no matter how efficient they are.
Well, this will help make the buses that are on the road more efficient, but frankly, that isn't the problem. The problem is that we don't really have good access to public transit in this country. It's only a small fraction of Americans actually live within a half a mile of a bus stop or a train station. So, again, going back to choice, most Americans don't have the option, the choice, to switch to public transit. So there needs to be a whole separate effort to design communities in smarter ways, to link them up with transit. And in the long run, that can have a big benefit. But right now, when you combine the heavy truck standards and the light truck standards, this literally represents the largest action any president has taken in the last 40 years to cut America's oil dependence, to cut global warming pollution, and to save consumers money on oil. This is a pretty big deal. Especially if on the light duty standards they can be finalized without any of the loopholes that Michelle and I have alluded to.
Well, let me just reintroduce the two of you. I also want to give out that phone number again. We're talking about the new fuel efficiency standards, what they'll mean for the auto and truck industry manufacturers. What's the technology to help meet some of these new standards? And will these new standards improve the environment and also be something that consumers want to buy? We're talking with David Friedman. He's an engineer, also deputy director of the Clean Vehicles Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Michelle Krebs is the editor-in-chief of Auto Observer and an analyst at Edmunds.com. In fact, she's been covering the automotive industry for about 30 years now. Both of them joining us today on Radio Times. And we do have some open lines. We'd be curious about the kinds of cars that you're looking for. How important is fuel efficiency when you consider buying a car? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Michelle, I remember from a couple of years ago when I guess we were also faced with high gas prices, and I guess it was candidate Obama talked about making sure that you had enough air in your tires. But that got me thinking about road maintenance, gridlock, traffic patterns. I mean, all the ways that we manage and drive our vehicles that actually make them less efficient. Can you expand on that?
Well, certainly, you know, the car maintenance and proper inflation of tires and that kind of thing makes a difference. The other thing that we're going to start seeing is more technologies that say that you are in a traffic jam and or you are at a light, the engine shuts down so it's not emitting pollution. Mm. one of my big beefs is when you're sitting at a light and you're the only one and you're, you know, the car is running and there's no one there. So, you know, I think there's a tremendous amount that could be done in terms of the infrastructure, in terms of there's been some pilot programs on experimenting with, you know, lights and those kinds of things. The road situation has to be dealt with too.
And David, I guess that's smart roads, right?
Right.
Well, smarter
roads. The broader concept is intelligent transportation systems, where everything from the stoplights to the vehicles to the tolls are all integrated, so that you can keep vehicles going at their optimal speed. In fact, part of what we're talking about here is what we were talking about at the beginning of the show. Why do the tests not reflect real-world driving? Well, the tests were created 40 years ago when we didn't have as much stop-and-go traffic, when we didn't have as many cars on the road, when most cars didn't even have air conditioning. So now with the modern car, with I think the great conveniences we have, but all the time we end up sitting alone in our cars stuck in traffic, it's created a big gap between those tests and what we see in the real world, and technologies can help with some of that. The integrated starter generator or start-stop systems that Michelle was referring to are really exciting. You pull up to a stoplight, the engine shuts off, the air conditioner can still run because that can be run off the battery in your car electronically, and then before your foot moves from the brake to the gas pedal, the engine is on and you're ready to go. You won't even notice any difference in acceleration. So it's impressive but simple technology that can save fuel and cut pollution.
And David, does that exist today?
Absolutely. General Motors has had it on some of their vehicles. They tried to market them as hybrids, which kind of hurt the technology because it delivered about a 10% boost in fuel economy, which is great. But when people think hybrids, they expect a 30, 40, 50% boost in fuel economy. But GM knows how to do this. They did a great job with the technology. They just mismarketed it. And they're about to introduce a standard in one of their Buick lines, former Buick.
No, it's still Buick.
Is it still Buick?
Okay, good.
Okay.
I
Thank
can't
you,
keep
Michelle.
Track of which models are
exactly.
coming up and down these days from GM. But yes, in the new one of the new Buicks, could be a LaCrosse. Michelle, maybe you'll know. They have this system built in as standard technology across that model.
Is that true, Michelle?
It's called eAssist, and so it's what I was referring to as something of a. It's not a full hybrid, but it's I would describe it as a mild hybrid. So it does many of the things that a hybrid does. But you know, and hybrids already do that. If you drive up to a light and you're sitting there very long, it shuts off. But we are going to see a lot more. Across all the manufacturers, start-stop mechanisms that do exactly that, on just gasoline cars.
Well, that's interesting. Let me get some callers in, and we have, it looks like, Fred from Asheville, North Carolina, joining us. And, Fred, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm right now finishing up a two-week road trip in my 2010 Prius, and the mileage has really fluctuated depending upon where I bought my gas. From like 54, 55, all the way down to 47, 48. The only thing that I can deduce is that this ethanol, the amount of ethanol, because in some cases it was a lot, in some cases it was less, seemed to track with the mileage. I just wonder if your guests would comment on that.
Well, I'll take a stab for it.
Go ahead,
Michelle. And I'm sure David has a comment. But first of all, you're in a mountainous area, I'm guessing, so... that will take more. Also, you know, you probably had the air conditioner on or off. Those kind of things make a huge difference. And in electric cars, you see that significantly.
And what about ethanol, David? Does that affect mileage?
It does affect mileage, but it definitely can explain the large variation that the caller saw. Michelle's right that probably a lot of it is driving conditions, but ethanol in cars varies from about 0% to 10%. At a 10% fraction, you could easily see in a Prius a 2 to 3 mile per gallon difference in your fuel economy, but definitely not a difference as large as the caller was seeing. That's got to be for different driving conditions, different temperatures, all sorts of things like that.
Fred,
and how fast you're going, Fred?
Oh, indeed, Fred. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me get Kevin from New Hampshire to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I'm calling about the position that your guests seem to be taking, that we should use tax policy to address driving behaviors. While I understand that concept, I think that it's really aimed at a homogenous group of drivers, assuming that people drive in the same way and that people have the same driving choices. There are millions of people who work every day where they don't drive from home to their workplace and then drive back at the end of the day. They drive from point A to point B to point C. Salesmen, I work in the insurance industry, I have to do that. Delivery people. So the driving behavior can't change, and tax policy will have a negative effect. Now, the only way that that would have a positive effect is in vehicle selection. I happen to have the ability to select my vehicle, which I'm very fortunate. So I chose a Honda Civic, which gets 37 miles a gallon, rather than maybe a larger sedan that would get mileage that's not as good. But as far as my driving behaviors, they can't change because it's just what I have to do for work.
Well, fair enough.
No, that was my point.
Yes, go ahead, Michelle.
My point was your vehicle choice.
And not behavior. I mean, as Kevin says, this is his job and this is how he has to get from point A to point B to point C.
Well, and the tricky thing with gas taxes is, again, basic economics. Price signals only work when consumers have more choices. And so right now, frankly, I don't think it would make sense to jack up the gas price at this point through taxes because most people don't have better options. 5, 10, 15 years down the line, once these fuel economy standards really kick in, and now instead of a 37-mile-per-gallon Civic, you can have a 50-mile-per-gallon Civic, then maybe it makes sense to start boosting some of those gas taxes.
The other thing that makes sense about at that point, David, and is the fact that if you're not using as much gas, you're not paying as much gas tax at current rates, which means that's the money used to support roads. So that's going to be a policy issue that has to be dealt with as well.
Exactly. In fact, that's where I was going to switch to next, which is already with the gas taxes where we are, we don't have enough money to
right.
fix potholes and bridges. But I don't think a gas tax is necessarily the way to handle that. I think the way to deal with that is a toll roads, and pay-as-you-drive insurance, and per-mile fees for driving. So, yes, the caller who works really hard for a living driving around, there would be some increases in cost if you pay a per-mile fee. But even there, studies have shown net costs will go down because if you keep the roads repaired, you won't have to repair your vehicle as often.
And we're going to have to take a break. Just to underscore that, I know from, I guess, the civil engineering organization that there are trillions of dollars of infrastructure projects to improve things like roads and highways. Thanks for calling into Radio Times, and we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, talking with David Friedman. He's an engineer, also deputy director of the Clean Vehicles Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Also with us is Michelle Krebs. She's the editor-in-chief of Auto Observer and analyst at Edmunds. Has been covering the automotive industry for 30 years, and both of them joining us today on Radio Times, talking about the Obama administration's new fuel efficiency standards for cars and for trucks. Stay with us. Call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Abington Friends School, a Quaker college preparatory school for students in preschool through grade 12. At Abington Friends, they know their students well. For all 4 years of upper school, students stay with the same faculty advisor, forming close relationships that often develop into lifelong friendships. Fully supported and valued for who they are and who they can be, Abington Friends helps students become more skillful at connecting, collaborating, and developing their abilities. More at abingtonfriends.net.
World War I was so bloody, 21,000 British soldiers were killed or fatally wounded in just one day. On the next Fresh Air, Adam Hochschild, author of To End All Wars, talks about the war and the people who opposed it, including men who refused the draft and soldiers who refused to fight, risking prison or execution. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A judge in Ohio rules that an Army vet can sue former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. The vet says he was imprisoned and tortured for whistleblowing. Also, a wordsmith says we need more superlatives. Awesome. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Michelle Krebs and David Friedman, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Michelle, I have a political question for you. I also have an email question for you, David, and then we'll get back to our callers. To you, Michelle, how was the Obama administration able to essentially make this announcement without having to go through Congress or get any kind of authorization from a congressional committee, for instance?
Oh, well, I am not an expert on that, but and it's not a done deal, by the way. Mm-hmm. There will be a public opinion comment period through the end of September. And then more of the rules will be developed. So I'm not a political expert.
I could grab that.
Let me see if David can tackle that. Go ahead, David.
Sure. Congress actually did give the president this authority. Back in 1975, during the first major oil crisis in the United States, Congress passed a law that required the administration to set corporate average fuel economy standards at the maximum feasible level. So the president has authority to set fuel economy standards. Back in 2007, that law was updated, again, still requiring the president to set maximum feasible fuel economy standards. In addition to this, Congress authorized something called the Clean Air Act. That's the act that's been largely responsible for cleaning up smog and toxic pollution and acid rain around the nation. What that law requires is the EPA must act if a pollutant harms human health and welfare. Hmm. And the Supreme Court a couple of years ago reconfirmed that EPA has the authority to regulate global warming pollution from automobiles under the Clean Air Act. So Congress has already given the administration this authority. They're just exercising the powers they already have.
Well, that's fascinating.
And remember, the Bush administration did a lot in terms of electric cars, and there was a big effort under President Bush to push that whole effort too.
So this is not that unusual when you look at this history. Let me read a question here. This is Sean from Philadelphia. He had an email question. How will these more complex and technologically advanced vehicles impact lifetime maintenance cost of these vehicles? And David, do you have an answer for Sean?
Sure. I think that's a really important and practical question. In a lot of cases for the conventional cars, I don't think you'll see a lot of impact. In fact, some of the transmissions we may be talking about, the dual-clutch transmissions, which are more efficient and give you more gears, in some ways are a little bit simpler and have less wear and tear than your typical automatic transmissions. So I would expect in terms of your engine, your transmission, things like that, you won't really see much of a difference. If we do move to electric vehicles, battery electric vehicles, in many ways you'll actually see less maintenance because it's just a simpler mm-hmm. system. Somewhere in between you have hybrids, which are a mix of electric vehicles, and conventional vehicles. I think in the near term you may see somewhat higher maintenance from those vehicles, but in the long term I don't expect you to really see a big difference. In fact, with a lot of these vehicles, because the engine spends more time off, you'll see a slightly lower wear and tear on that engine.
Michelle, you want to add to that?
Well, and if you look at the transition we made from, you know, the Toyota Prius has been on the roads for 10 years, and we made that transition fairly easily, and the manufacturers do a pretty good job of training dealers and technicians on, you know, the newest technologies.
Let me get Paul from Florida to join our conversation. And Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was telling the screener that I'm a small trucking businessman. I own and operate one truck, and I believe that I recognize government has a role in reducing pollution and a national security issue with energy, but I believe this is going too far. Most people don't realize that since 2003, we have had emissions control standards on large trucks. We went through a cycle in 2003 and 2007. And just now in 2010. And the technologies that they've had to put on these trucks are so new and so radical that when they break, they don't know how to fix them. Mm. I have friends that have gone into the shop 14 times this last year because of what is called an EGR, exhaust gas recirculation issue, and nobody knows how to fix it. It's costing him downtime. It's costing him repairs. We need time to get our hands around what's already been done with the emissions before we go even further.
Well, Paul, that's very interesting. And I'm as you said, you drive a truck. You have a trucking company?
Yes, and I have a pre-emissions regulated truck.
And what kind?
And I will keep it as long as I can.
Oh, I understand that. And I'm curious, what kind of mileage do you get?
And that's the second part of my question,
okay. Or
that's the second part of my my comment, is we don't need the government telling us how to get better fuel mileage because we're already doing it ourselves. This truck can get as bad as 5.5 miles per gallon, but because of the tires that I've put on here, the filters that I've put on here, the changes in the computer that I've made, everything that I've been doing, I've been able to get it up to 7.5 to 8 miles per gallon. And this is a pre-emissions truck. We are working as hard as we can to get better fuel mileage because 0.1 mile per gallon saves me $1,000 a year right now.
I hear you. Well, Paul, first of all, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And let me toss that first to you, David Friedman. I mean, obviously, he has some concerns about the kinds of regulations and obviously the costs associated with it as well.
Sure. And I mean, my first advice would be to encourage Paul to encourage his friends to find a different mechanic because EGR technology has been around and a pretty standard technology for about 40 years. So if their mechanic is having trouble getting that fixed, then they need to find a different mechanic.
Hmm.
You know, I very much take Paul's point, though. I mean, people in the trenches are working really hard every day to save money, especially when you see gas prices and diesel prices where they are today. And I think Paul's doing a great job making sure that his engine is and vehicle is operating in tip-top shape. The thing is, with these new standards, he'll get help in making sure that the next truck he buys gets about 20% better fuel economy, and then he can add on top of that with all the good work that he's doing. The analysis shows that someone like Paul could potentially be saving $50,000 to $70,000 over the life of their truck on diesel for technology that costs a lot less.
Well,
so
Paul,
there's a lot of progress to happen here.
Paul, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. So let me get Karen from Phoenixville to join us, and Michelle, I'll put her question to you. And Karen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm just calling in to make a comment about an earlier caller who said that his driving behavior couldn't be changed. But my husband and I both have been driving Honda Civic and an Insight hybrid since 2003. And first I'll say they have been problem-free. They have just been great. We have no complaints that way. They have not been any more expensive than a regular car to drive. And my final comment is that we actually feel that you can get as good a mileage as they state. You know, previously, I get 48 miles per gallon around town in my car. You can actually watch the gauges that gives you a moment-by-moment reading of what your miles per gallon is. And, for example, if I'm driving and I'm getting 48.4 miles per gallon, I know that. Now, if I stop at a red light and then I do a jackrabbit start
and
really,
see it.
You know, jump on it, then I can see my mileage go down by 4.4 you know, increments.
Right.
So it might go down to 48.0, and I see that. So I can go, gee, I'd really like to have better mileage today. I'm not going to do a really fast start.
Well, Karen, let me take your point because it's an interesting one, and I know,
yeah.
Michelle, some
it's
of
like
this...
like biofeedback.
Well, it's exactly what I was going to say, and Michelle, this is... I mean, obviously, Karen's taking advantage of the biofeedback loop in her car.
Absolutely. I mean, I've actually taken classes in how you can improve your driving so that you get better fuel economy. There are people that they're called hypermilers that do everything meticulously to try to get the absolute maximum mileage out of their vehicle. So driver behavior absolutely does impact fuel economy as well.
David, is this are we seeing the end of the SUV, or is it just going to be a greener, cleaner SUV?
It's going to be a greener, cleaner SUV. I mean, we're already seeing some market shift from SUVs to what people typically call crossovers. And one of the big reasons why the SUV exists is because in the 90s, automakers took advantage of a loophole in safety and emissions regulations that more or less exempted SUVs, or at least gave them much weaker standards. So they basically took pickup trucks and turned them into cars for consumers. And a lot of consumers flocked to those vehicles. But what we've been finding in the last 5 to 10 years is that's not really what consumers wanted. Maybe they wanted a bigger vehicle, but they wanted to drive it like a car, not a truck. So now you see a lot more bigger vehicles. They're kind of like big station wagons or smaller to medium-sized SUVs that are built on a car platform. They're more comfortable, they're more fun, easier to drive. You're going to see those crossovers. You're going to see the SUVs. You're going to see plenty of F-150 pickups. Consumers will have all the choices they have today, but you'll actually be able to afford to drive them when gas prices go up.
Both you and Michelle have mentioned loopholes. Do we have enough information to know whether there are similar loopholes in these new rules?
Well, there's definitely a couple of things. One, there's still a gap between car and truck standards. So there's going to be some incentive for car companies to try to tweak around the edges to qualify their cars as trucks. The other big challenge is that the administration decided to go very weak on your bigger pickup trucks. So those bigger pickup trucks will get better fuel economy through 2016, but then they're going to kind of take a pause. So I'm personally worried that small businesses are going to take a hit on this because they're not going to have the same technology that the rest of the market has to save fuel.
Michelle, is there concern with smaller, lighter cars that they're less safe?
Well, you can't defy some of the laws of physics, but the smaller cars are being built in a way that many of them are safer. I mean, the roads are safer than they've ever been, despite, if you know someone who's been hurt or killed in an accident. The numbers are actually down, especially for the number of miles we meet. Plus, let's remember, at the same time that we're improving fuel economy and emissions, there are more regulations going into effect for safety. And David mentioned earlier high-strength steel. A lot of that is going, new materials and high-strength steel and building better cages so that it absorbs the energy and so that the passengers, all of that is being worked into new vehicles.
Let me get, looks like Bill from Gilbertsville to join our conversation. And Bill, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Thank you very much for taking my call. Love the show, by the way.
Thank you.
And I have a question for your panel. I hear in today's discussion a lot of work on future vehicles, and using existing technologies going forward. But is there any research being done on work for existing vehicles that are on the road? And I was thinking along the lines of maybe cylinder deactivation or some kind of stop-start mechanism for the engine. I run a V8 that, runs very inefficiently, and I'm looking for some ways to make it more efficient. I was wondering if your panel would be able to answer that question. I'll take it off the air.
Well, Bill, before you go, what kind of car do you drive? What kind of car do you drive?
I have a Ford Expedition with a V8 engine, and I can't afford to change it out, but I certainly would like to find if there's some other technologies that could be retrofitted to the vehicle that would make it more fuel efficient.
And what kind of mileage do you get with your car?
It varies in around the city. I'm probably getting around 12 miles to the gallon, and if I take it very carefully and no jackrabbit starts, I can get up to about 15 or 16 on the highway.
Right. So you're using a lot of fuel. David Friedman, can you help him out?
Well, hopefully, when he is getting that 12 to 15 miles per gallon, he's got several other people packed into that large vehicle, so that he's actually making a lot more person miles to the gallon. Those big vehicles can be very useful for moving a lot of people. So if that's what he's doing, then, it can make sense. In terms of retrofits, there really aren't a lot of retrofits out there. And, in fact, I typically caution people to be skeptical when you see a marketing pitch for some way to change your vehicle that you have right now to get much higher fuel economy. Either A, a lot of them are false, or B, it's probably going to cost you just about as much money as it would cost you to get a new car if you really want to do it right. There are a lot of risks with retrofitting your existing vehicle, so I'm sorry to say, Bill, but I would say that you're stuck with your gas guzzler for now, but when you're ready to get a new vehicle, thanks to these standards, you're going to be a lot better off. And
You also avoid the warranty when you do those kinds of retrofits, so that's very risky.
Very risky. Michelle, let me put the final question to you. We've been talking about these new efficiency standards announced at the end of July. There was the president flanked by union members, auto executives. How would you describe the health of the U.S. auto industry today?
Well, last week I would have described it as much healthier.
I realize
than
it depends on what day or what hour I ask you that question.
You know, we were last week. Here's what I would say generally:
okay.
All the auto markers are in far better shape than they were. Be it Chrysler and GM going through bankruptcy and getting rid of a lot of debt, but they've tightened up their capacity, so they're building cars that, you know, more in line with what the demand is, so they aren't building up these huge inventories. So they've gotten their infrastructure costs in place. They've negotiated better deals with the unions, and they're at the negotiation tables right now for another contract. Their balance sheets are way healthier than they were a few years ago.
Well, on that note, I thank both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Michelle Krebs, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's the editor-in-chief of Auto Observer and an analyst at Edmunds.com. And she's been covering the automotive industry for about 30 years now. And David Friedman, thank you very much as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. He's an engineer, also deputy director of the Clean Vehicles Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for listening and for joining us today on Radio Times.